Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds.
It's the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Bill Westmiller, sitting in while Walt Thiessen takes a vacation, for which he is very thankful. Today is Thursday, November 21st. I'm looking forward to having a guest for today's show, author Ira Stoll, whose new book, JFK Conservative, will be released tomorrow, which is the 50th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination. He hasn't connected with us yet. I'll give you a little bit of an introduction when he's available. We had hoped to spend the first half hour talking about the JFK legacy and why he calls Kennedy a conservative rather than a liberal, and then discuss a little bit about Obamacare. Ira Stoll has been an editor of the Future of Capitalism website, has written on JFK, written on Obamacare, and a lot of other issues. In the meantime, while we're waiting for Gary to call in, let's bounce to some of the news that's come up this past week. Obamacare, of course, is in the news with all the latest apologies and revisions and changes in the program. The most recent of them has been that Obama has decided that he's going to try to keep his promise that anyone who has a policy, medical insurance policy, will be able to keep it. And if you have a doctor, you'll be able to keep the doctor. That turned out not to be quite true. Under the provisions of the law itself, insurance policies that don't conform with the Affordable Care Act simply have to be terminated at the end of this year. And that means that millions of people have lost their insurance coverage, gotten a notice from their carrier that they're no longer covered. Well, that created something of a ruckus after denying that he had said you could keep your insurance policy and watching 30 or 40 videos indicating that is exactly what he had said. He said, well, I gave improper assurances and we're going to do everything we can to solve the problem. And the way he decided to solve it was to send a letter to the various insurance commissioners in each of the states, asking them to ignore the law. In other words, even though the law says that these insurance policies have to terminate and have to comply as of January 1st, the federal government is not going to be enforcing that law for the next year. So he is asking, because the state insurance commissioners and the insurance laws govern what insurance companies can do, he's asking those insurance commissioners to notify all the carriers that it's okay to extend contracts through January 1st. Now, there are several of the insurance commissioners who have said, okay, we're going to, you know, invoke a special circumstance for the next year and allow people who had previous policies to have them continue through 2014. Well, that's became problematic for almost all of the states because they have existing laws, not federal laws, but state laws, that specify exactly how an insurance policy can be offered by the various insurance carriers. They have to have certain provisions. They have to have a certain termination date or termination clauses. They can't just change the contracts that they have in place and without violating the law. So a lot of the insurance commissioners have basically told the Department of Health and Human Services, no, we can't do that. It's not just a violation of federal law. It's also a violation of state law. So there's a great deal of scrambling going on in order to resolve this this problem, which has caused Obama's favorability ratings to take a nosedive over the last few months. So it's still an unresolved problem, and the problem is that if people don't sign up for a qualified health insurance program by December 15th, they will not have one in effect on January 1st. And they've said, well, we'll allow it to be postponed for 90 days until March 30th so that people can have a little bit more time to actually get their insurance policy. But whether or not that is actually complies with the Affordable Care Act is seriously in doubt. So it's going to be an interesting time over the next few months as we develop exactly what's going to become of Obamacare. We do have Ira Stoll with us. Thanks for joining us, Ira.
My pleasure. Happy to be here.
Yeah. Let me give you a little intro. Mr. Stoll is the editor of the Future of Capitalism website. He's a regular contributor to Reason Magazine, other online journals. He was the president and managing editor of the former New York Sun, managing editor of The Forward, which was published from 2002 to 2008. Previously, he served as a Washington correspondent of The Forward and was a North American editor of the Jerusalem Post. We'll get back to some of the Obamacare news a little bit later, but let's devote our first segment to the legacy of John F. Kennedy, the 35th President of the United States. Your book is coming out tomorrow, which is obviously the anniversary, and that makes a good deal of sense. I'm sure you've done all kinds of research into the JFK legacy, but aside from all your research, what do you think most people remember of Kennedy? What do they think of him?
Well, most Americans today don't remember Kennedy. They weren't even alive at the time he was killed. And I count myself among them. So really our memory of Kennedy is shaped by, partly it's the spin of his more liberal advisors who wrote some best-selling books after he died, Ted Sorensen and Arthur Schlesinger Jr. And what I do in my book, JFK Conservative, is try to pierce those myths and get at the real JFK, get past the distortions that those guys committed in trying to portray Kennedy as more liberal than he actually was. I think people remember that President Kennedy was young and good-looking and had a good-looking wife, but what I try to focus on my book is the policy issues, that JFK was a tax cutter, that he believed that you could get economic growth by cutting tax rates, that he believed in peace through strength and increased military spending. And both of those policies were later picked up by President Reagan, who I think was really, of the presidents that came after JFK, the one that most faithfully adhered to Kennedy's legacy.
Well, but is it just a myth, the impression? I'm old enough that I was, 17 or 18 when the assassination occurred. So he was a man of my time, so to speak. I happen to have a Catholic background, and of course he was the first Catholic to be elected president. But the image in people's minds, whether they were alive during his presidency or not, is of really good times, of a Camelot, of a fantasy, of a wonderful young president who was articulate and beautiful wife and kids, and he knew what he was doing, and he was educated in all the proper schools, and he was the ideal of what we think of as a good American president. Isn't that what people still hold on to?
I think that era of good feeling thing, it's true in retrospect, but there were certainly some dark moments during the Kennedy administration. I mean, the failed invasion of the Bay of Pigs, the bombing of black churches in the South, the escalation of the war in Vietnam. It's all kind of bathed in this hazy, posthumous gauze of Camelot. But, I think if we look at the facts of the matter, as I try to do in this book, JFK Conservative, you'll see it's a mixed record. And I say that as somebody who's really an admirer of JFK and who admires Kennedy's optimism and his patriotism and his morally based and religiously based belief that the Cold War was a battle of what he called good versus evil, right versus wrong.
When people think back, if you probably ask the man in the streets to cite what they recall Kennedy had accomplished, what he had actually done, they'll probably think of the challenge to put men on the moon. They'll think of the Peace Corps. Maybe they'll think of some civil rights advances that he made. But when I went back to look at the actual legislative achievements, they're very sparse. There were very few things that were actually, of course, he was only in office for 2 years, but there were very few things that he actually changed or implemented during his term.
Well, he was in office for almost 3 years, and there was a pretty dramatic increase in military spending, along with the escalation of the war in Vietnam. And immediately after his death, I mean, I think it's fair to credit Kennedy for what's universally known as the Kennedy tax cut, which was really actually a significant thing. I mean, that was a model for Reagan's tax cuts. And it brought the top income tax rate in the U.S. down from 91% to 70%. Kennedy wanted it down to 65%. He wanted the capital gains tax rate even lower at 19.5%. And then the civil rights legislation, which Kennedy proposed in his final year, I think you could say he was slow to achieve it, but Johnson finally got it passed. And really, the tax cut and the civil rights legislation were the two legislative memorials to President Kennedy, and I think they were seen that way at the time. You know, while Kennedy was alive, there was his top priority in 1962 legislatively was free trade negotiating authority, and that led to the Kennedy round of trade negotiations, which reduced tariffs on about 6,500 items by as much as 35%. So we forget sometimes that free trade is a tax cut, because American consumers buy those imported items, and when there's free trade, the taxes on the imports are less. So that was a big tax cut too. And Clinton, when he was trying to get the North American Free Trade Agreement passed, actually went to the Kennedy Library in Boston and talked about Kennedy's legacy as a free trader.
That's great, but would it be correct to characterize those policy positions as conservative? Because at least in terms of philosophy, we think of him more as a liberal or maybe even a classical liberal. His speeches and so on were very much in the liberal vein rather than the conservative vein. And the famous quote, ask not what the government can do for you, but what you can do for the country, is an appeal to a liberal mindset of being helpful and participating in society and at least in a liberal sense of increasing the amount of freedom, increasing the opportunities, and so on and so forth. So even though you might cite several things that would be classified today as conservative, wasn't he philosophically a liberal?
Well, I guess it depends on what you mean by a liberal. If you're talking about a classical liberal, someone who believes in natural rights and individual freedom, then yeah, that's what Kennedy was. But the meaning of the term liberal has really changed over time, and Kennedy was quite aware of that, to the point where liberal now means you're for a big government and a powerful federal government at the expense of state and local government, and that's not at all where Kennedy was.
I was listening to some audio tapes that have recently been released of Kennedy talking about the Vietnam War, which wasn't a war while Kennedy was there. They had a bunch of advisors and so on, but he seemed to be a tactician. He wanted a victory in Vietnam, and he was providing support to the South Vietnamese government. But he seemed to be focused entirely on tactical issues, whether this particular policy would get a win or whether he should allow conspirators to overthrow Diem, and so on. He didn't seem to have an overall focus as to what he wanted to accomplish in terms of military policy.
Well, you know, let me just read you a few lines from Kennedy in Kennedy's own words, which I think do sort of sum up his overall philosophy. Here's some lines from his speech in 1955 at Assumption College in actually my hometown of Worcester, Massachusetts, where he said about the Cold War, "I believe religion itself is at the root of the struggle, not in terms of the physical organizations of Christianity versus those of atheism, but in terms of good versus evil, right versus wrong." Here he is during the 1960 campaign at the Mormon Tabernacle in Salt Lake City, where he said, "The enemy is the communist system itself, implacable, insatiable, unceasing in its drive for world domination. It is also a struggle for supremacy between two conflicting ideologies, freedom under God versus ruthless, godless tyranny." Or here he is in the inaugural address, "The same revolutionary beliefs for which our forefathers fought are still at issue around the globe, the belief that rights of man come not from the generosity of the state, but from the hand of God." So, you know, I think that's pretty clear when he talks about two conflicting ideologies, freedom under God versus ruthless, godless tyranny. That was Kennedy's really Cold War outlook, and he was determined to fight communist expansion wherever he could and support freedom wherever he could, whether it was Vietnam or Cuba or anywhere else. And the Peace Corps was part of that. I mean, it wasn't like Kennedy just wanted to help poor people in poor countries. He knew that if the U.S. wasn't out there building wells or immunizing children or helping to build dams, the Soviet advisors would be in there doing that. And the space race was the same way. It was really a battle to beat the Russians to the moon. There's one of those tapes of a meeting with Kennedy and the director of NASA talking about the space exploration budget. And Kennedy says, "Every dime we spend ought to be focused on beating the Russians to the moon, because you know what? I'm not that interested in space."
Yeah, when it came down to actual military policy, perhaps the most negative historic signature thing for his legacy was the Bay of Pigs invasion, which is an absolute and total failure.
That's right. And, you know, Kennedy could have just given up at that point on Cuba, but he didn't. He actually worked very hard to sort of ransom the jailed Cuban rebels who'd been captured at the Bay of Pigs, to the point of putting a team at the IRS in charge of making sure that American companies who donated food or medicine as part of this ransom effort could get tax deductions for it. He got $1 million in cash from the Catholic Church in Boston that went towards this ransom money. And then when the rebels returned to the United States, Kennedy met with them at the Orange Bowl in Miami, presented them with a flag, which he said he hoped would one day fly over free Cuba. And we know also there were covert activities going on, as so-called Operation Mongoose, attempts to assassinate Castro during the Kennedy administration. So even though he flinched at the Bay of Pigs, and that was a failed operation, he was still determined to get Castro. And, you know, some people have faulted him for failing to succeed at that. But, you know, I think you have to look at every other president since then has seen Castro outlast them, whether it's Reagan or George W. Bush or you name it. So it's kind of one of the ironies of history that the Cuban dictator in communist Cuban dictator has served, has outlived a lot of these American presidents.
The other episode, of course, that is notable in the history books is the nuclear confrontation. And I've done a fair amount of reading on that particular situation. And basically, the Russians were responding to the fact that we had nuclear missiles in Turkey and parts of Eastern Europe that were directly and immediately short-range, threats to the Soviet Union. And that was their motive for attempting to put the missiles in Cuba. And that the resolution of that was a secret. It was a secret agreement nobody knew anything about. They thought the Russians had backed down, but in fact it was a negotiated settlement where we agreed to take our nuclear weapons out of Turkey and Eastern Europe in exchange for Russia withdrawing the nuclear weapons from Cuba. But most people don't seem to be aware that that was actually what happened. It was a secret at the time.
Yeah, and so the result is that it was a big global propaganda victory for the United States. I mean, it really looked like the Soviets had backed down, and it really played as a win for the United States to the point where Khrushchev was basically forced out of the leadership of the Soviet Union pretty soon thereafter.
Is there anything in your book that's a new revelation? Because there seems to be a lot of information still hidden about the Soviet deal, about the assassination, about other things that transpired during that period.
Well, I have a whole chapter on the tax cut, and I think people who are interested in Kennedy as a tax cutter, as a precedent to the Reagan tax cuts, will be very interested in that chapter. You know, liberals have tried to portray that as a Keynesian tax cut designed to increase the budget deficit or put money in the pockets of lower-income people so that they would then go spend it. But I really demolish that in the book. I report, for example, that John Kenneth Galbraith, one of the leading Keynesian economists in the Kennedy administration, actually opposed the Kennedy tax cut. He wrote a letter to Kennedy saying, as usual, I would oppose a tax cut. He even flew back from his job as ambassador to India to argue with Kennedy at the White House against it. He wanted more government spending instead. And Galbraith, after that meeting, went back to the White House mess and told his colleagues in the Kennedy administration, he said, you know what? You guys have won. The president finally told me to shut up about my opposition to the tax cut. Even Al Gore Sr., the Democratic senator from Tennessee, who is the father of Bill Clinton's vice president, Kennedy met up with him at Eleanor Roosevelt's funeral and asked him, what do you think I should do about the tax cut? And Gore tried to talk him out of it. And the conversation was so heated that President Eisenhower was standing nearby, couldn't even get into the conversation. And which, when they left the funeral and went back to the nearby airport, Kennedy was on one plane and Gore was on another plane. Kennedy sent for Gore to continue the conversation on the airplane ride home. But then Gore was quoted in Tennessee newspaper headlines denouncing the Kennedy plan tax cut as what he called a bonanza for fat cats. And even the AFL-CIO wanted to restructure the tax cut so that less of the benefits went to what they call the rich and more of them went to lower-income people. But Kennedy was adamant against that, and his Treasury Secretary, Douglas Dillon, was a Wall Street banker. I write in this book, JFK Conservative, that Dillon wanted the people who paid the most taxes to get a tax break, and he wanted to affect not just people's ability to spend money, but also their ability to save and invest. So that's why even capital gains tax rates were cut under the Kennedy plan tax cut.
So Kennedy believed in the Laffer curve before there was a Laffer curve?
Absolutely. I mean, that was his argument, that if you cut the tax rates, the economic growth generated would be enough that the government would end up with more revenue. I mean, that wasn't the only argument for the tax cut. You know, just the fact that government revenues would go up isn't sufficient justification for doing anything. But he said, among other things, that he thought that individuals could use the money more productively than government could.
That's certainly not a liberal position. I don't recall that he ever cited anyone. Did he ever describe the source of his ideas on economic policy?
He didn't really credit anyone. I think this Douglas Dillon was quite influential, though, more than any of the Ivy League economists in the administration, this Wall Street banker who had actually donated to the Eisenhower-Nixon campaign and had served in the Eisenhower administration turned out to be quite an influential voice on economic policy. And he came in right from the beginning as a tax cutter, to the point where, again, Senator Gore went to Kennedy and tried to talk him out of the appointment. It's basically saying, what are you doing appointing this Republican Wall Street type as your Treasury Secretary? And again, Kennedy ignored the advice.
Is there anything that the Kennedy did that still affects average people's lives today? In other words, was there, aside from the things that were carried forward and implemented by Johnson, and aside from what was eventually accomplished with the moon landing, what can we credit in our lives today as having been contributed by Kennedy?
Well, I think these ideas that Reagan picked up of peace through strength and tax cuts leading to economic growth, that are still, you know, important ideas in the Republican Party in this country. Maybe Kennedy wasn't the first to propound those ideas, but certainly Reagan talked about Kennedy all the time, both on the tax cutting and on the foreign policy, particularly in the Western Hemisphere. And, you know, I think, If I had to describe the two key points of Kennedy's policy legacy, I think that those were the ones.
Is there anything that we'll find in your book that is new aside from the analysis of his policy issues? Is there a disclosure about things that Kennedy did or didn't do in secret, or that was useful and important to understanding his presidency?
Well, this is the first book that argues at full length that he was a conservative from an admiring point of view. I mean, there are some liberals who have written biographies of Kennedy sort of trashing him for being too right-wing, but this is an admiring biography that talks about the religious influence on Kennedy's life. Goes into great detail about his congressional and Senate career as a anti-communist, talks about some votes he made on, for instance, cutting off U.S. aid to countries that traded with communist China, where Kennedy voted with Senator McCarthy and Barry Goldwater and even liberal Republicans like Prescott Bush and Leverett Salt-N-Sol were on the other side. In terms of what came out, I mean, I think, you know, there's all these tapes of Kennedy's Oval Office conversations, including on civil rights, that conversation on the space program that I mentioned, the context about the tax cut, and then just bringing it up to the present through Clinton and Reagan and even Obama in terms of what, how Kennedy has influenced them, how they match up to Kennedy, and doing it all in a relatively short and, I think, lively package. All that is new. I don't think anyone has done that. If they had, I would be no point to my writing the book.
Your book available in bookstores, Amazon, standard outlets?
Yep, I think it's at Costco as well. JFK Conservative by Ira Stoll.
Okay, we're going to speculate a little bit about how Kennedy might have responded to some of our current challenges, but we're going to take a break for a minute or two, and we'll be right back with Ira Stoll. We're back with Ira Stoll, the author of JFK Conservative, and also the editor of the Future of Capitalism website. I'm Bill Westmiller. Let me just make a program note that Walt Thiessen is on vacation, and we will not be on the air next Thursday, which, of course, is Thanksgiving Day. But Walt will be back hosting the program the first week of December, so we invite you to join us then. Ira's written a book that talks about a lot of different economic policies that he classifies as conservative in the JFK administration, policy positions, and so on and so forth. Since the big news over the past couple of months in the U.S. is Obamacare and universal health insurance, let me ask you this. Did Kennedy harbor or advance the progressive ideal of universal government health care?
Absolutely not. I mean, it was only Nixon who came up with that one. Kennedy gave a couple speeches in favor of Medicare, but he didn't really fight for it much, to the point where liberals within the administration were disappointed with him for focusing on free trade and tax cuts as opposed to Medicare or aid to education. When he proposed Medicare in his February 1961 message to Congress on health, Kennedy described the plan for the elderly as, quote, a very modest proposal cut to meet absolutely essential needs and with sufficient deductible requirements to discourage any malingering or unnecessary overcrowding of our hospitals. He went on, this program is not a program of socialized medicine. It's a program of prepayment of health costs with absolute freedom of choice guaranteed. Every person will choose his own doctor and hospital. The program is a sound one and entirely in accordance with the traditional American system of placing responsibility on the employee and the employer rather than on the general taxpayers to help finance retirement and health costs.
Now, wait a second. I thought Medicare had been implemented long before Kennedy came into office. Am I totally wrong?
Well, that Medicaid, the program for the poor, I think existed, but Medicare didn't come in until the Johnson administration.
But it was a Kennedy proposal.
Well, the proposal had been around for a while, I think dating back to the New Deal, but actually Medicaid also wasn't created until 1965, the Great Society.
Sometimes Medicare and Medicaid are characterized as having been a part of our history for centuries, if not decades. Is there anything about Kennedy's personality in the implementation, or again, this is pure speculation, if he had gotten the Medicare provisions approved during his administration, do you think they would have been administered any better than the Obamacare program?
Well, you know, Medicare is pretty popular, I guess. But remember, Kennedy had come in the inauguration with this famous line, ask not what your country can do for you. So, you know, we've kind of gone from that philosophy to a philosophy of universal health care, food stamps, Pell Grants, you know, almost cradle to grave government subsidies and welfare programs. And, you know, Kennedy was quite aware of the risk of perverse incentives. And, you know, when he says he wanted to discourage any malingering, even on the aid to dependent children program, which did exist during the Kennedy administration, he was aware of the way that encouraged fathers to leave their children, because the only single mothers got aid under that program. So he was quite concerned about changing welfare from a program that encouraged dependency and broke up families to one that focused on training for work and getting people into jobs rather than prolonged dependency.
As you're describing this, I'm thinking maybe you got the wrong title for your book. Maybe it should have been JFK Libertarian.
Well, you know, on foreign policy, the libertarians tend to not be in favor of increased military spending and be quite cautious about foreign adventures in places like Vietnam or Berlin. So, you know, I think that's really where Kennedy would part ways with the libertarians. But on the other hand, there really are certain Kennedy quotes which sound quite libertarian. I mean, he gave a speech in 1950 at Notre Dame in which he warned the ever-expanding power of the federal government, the absorption of many of the functions that states and cities once considered to be the responsibilities of their own, must now be a source of concern to all those who believe, as did the Irish patriot Henry Grattan, control over local affairs is the essence of liberty.
The philosophical speeches that Kennedy gave are impressive, but as a technician, as an administrator of the government, do you think he was successful, or whether in foreign policy or domestic policy or economic, how would you compare him with Obama?
Well, I think he's a lot more successful than Obama. I mean, the Kennedy tax cuts ignited a series of years of really quite robust economic growth. I mean, there was 4, 5, even 6% growth after those Kennedy tax cuts. I mean, of course, it was already the Johnson administration, but I think if Kennedy had lived, he really could have taken credit for that. Whereas Obama, you know, has been trying to raise taxes, our economic growth has been pretty anemic. The unemployment rate, you know, it's gone down a little, but it's still pretty high. Kennedy was escalating the Vietnam War. Obama's been, withdrew troops from Iraq, and after a brief surge in Afghanistan, is withdrawing from Afghanistan.
Well, by 2024, we find out today they're not all going to be out by the end of 2014. But this brings us to something that I discovered just a couple of days ago, and that was that the NSA, the National Security Administration, agency rather, which has been all over the news with the Snowden revelations and so on and so forth. The NSA itself was actually formed back in 1946, and there were a variety of different programs, I think you mentioned one, that were active while Kennedy was president. How did he view those kind of intelligence operations, and would he have approved of what the NSA has been doing in the past 10 years?
Well, you know, I think it's a balance. I think on one hand, Kennedy was skeptical of a powerful central government and spoke a lot about the rights of the individual versus the state. But when it came right down to it, I mean, he knew that America was in a very high stakes global conflict with the Soviet Union, and I think he wanted every advantage he could have in that conflict. So, certainly, I mean, for example, the U.S. Postal Service was authorized in the Kennedy administration to intercept mail that was communist, either coming from China or the Soviet Union or even communist propaganda within the United States. So, you know, there wasn't email at that time, so intercepting actual, you know, old-fashioned newsletters is, you know, kind of like, you know, intercepting all those emails today, I suppose. And, you know, the Soviet Union was a real threat. I mean, you could argue it was even a more formidable threat than the threat of militant Islamic terrorism. Although, you know, the Soviet Union never destroyed the World Trade Center in New York and killed 3,000 people, but I think militant Islam, like fundamentalism, violent terrorism like that is a real threat too. But you know, they don't have hundreds of nuclear missiles pointed at us or tanks, you know, arrayed in Eastern Europe.
True. However, from what I read, and correct me if I'm wrong, the CIA really blundered in terms of evaluating the power of the Soviet Union, that their economic system was way overblown estimates of their capabilities economically, their capabilities militarily, even their capabilities to influence other countries around the world. That it was a total distortion of their power, and the collapse came naturally as a consequence of their system, rather than anything that Kennedy or Johnson or Reagan did.
Well, you know, it's hard to know that what would have the counterfactual there, right? Because we don't have an experiment of, you know, would the Soviet
right.
Union have collapsed if Reagan hadn't built up a 500 ship navy and started Star Wars missile defense and all that. I mean, there's just no way to know. I think it is true that our American intelligence agencies overestimated Soviet strength and didn't predict its collapse. But remember, during the Kennedy period, you know, the Soviets had beaten America into space with Sputnik. They beat America into having an astronaut in space with I guess it was Yuri Gagarin. And, you know, so America had an image to protect, and it wasn't the Soviet challenge was not totally an illusion. I mean, it was a real global conflict.
Given how he responded to that challenge, again, pure speculation, how do you think Kennedy, based on what he said, or what he actually did, how he would have responded to an event like 9/11?
Well, you know, one thing Kennedy did was he took advice from all sides. So when he found out that the Soviets had put nuclear missiles in Cuba, he gathered his advisors, and there was quite an extended conversation with a range of views, ranging from the liberal ambassador to the United Nations, Adlai Stevenson, who said Kennedy should do nothing. After all, if the Soviets launched nuclear missiles at us from Cuba, we'd be just as dead as if the missiles came from mainland Russia, you know, just maybe 5 minutes earlier. To the Air Force Chief of Staff, Curtis LeMay, who was basically taking a bomb Cuba back to the Stone Age approach, you know, launch a preemptive nuclear attack. So, and Kennedy took a middle course with the naval blockade and quarantine of Cuba that eventually led the Soviets to back down and pull the missiles out. So, you know, I think had Kennedy been president on 9/11, he would have taken advice from a whole array of advisors, and I don't think he would have been hesitant to use force, because Kennedy did use force after the Cuban Missile Crisis with this blockade. He did escalate the number of U.S. troops in Vietnam. He did send tanks in Berlin at certain times. But he also, you know, he had been in World War II, and he knew the cost involved. He'd lost his brother in that war, and he'd seen some of his crewmates in PT-109 die. So he was quite aware of the real human cost of war. So I think to some extent Kennedy would have been cautious before launching a full-scale American war, because you know, he knew what that meant in terms of lives.
Okay, let's try another one. The financial crisis of 2009. How would he have responded to that, aside from just talking to advisors first?
Well, Kennedy had a fairly steep stock market crash. Not crash, but the stock market took quite a dive at one point in the Kennedy administration, and he had an assistant secretary of commerce call a lot of people on Wall Street and ask for advice. Some of his friends who were businessmen, actually the publisher of the Washington Post, Philip Graham, wrote him a memo, and John Kenneth Galbraith, this Keynesian Harvard economics professor who was ambassador to India, also wrote a memo advising Kennedy to read his book on the history of the Great Depression, which must have really inspired a lot of confidence in Kennedy that, you know, he was afraid there was going to be another Great Depression on their hands with this, you know, stock market dip in the 1960s.
So you don't think you would have done a bailout of the banks and the various investment houses that Bush and
I certainly hope not. I mean, Kennedy, I think, had a healthy respect for the division between government and private industry, and I think he would have been quite hesitant to, you know, even though his Treasury Secretary, like Henry Paulson, Bush's Treasury Secretary during the financial crisis, was a Wall Street banker, I'd be very, very surprised if Kennedy, you know, made what I think was a mistake of bailing out those banks.
You mentioned that Kennedy's treasurer was somewhat of an Austrian economist. Do you have any background on what prompted him to have that kind of an attitude, and why Kennedy backed him? Was there a personality thing there?
You know, certainly Kennedy grew up during the period when you know, Hayek's Road to Serfdom had been a runaway bestseller and had been excerpted in Reader's Digest at the same time when, very close to when the story of Kennedy's survival after the PT-109 crash was excerpted in Reader's Digest. It had originally appeared in the New Yorker. So they were kind of moving around in parallel times, but I didn't find any evidence that Kennedy ever met Hayek or von Mises or any of those Austrian economists.
Do you take a shot at the conspiracy theories, which, according to the recent polls, anywhere from 55% to 61% still think that it wasn't Oswald working alone? Do you think it had something to do with Cuba or his attempts to assassinate Castro? Do you touch on that in the book at all?
I think Oswald killed Kennedy. You know, whether there were other people involved, you know, I think it's very hard for anybody to say for sure. I do think that some of these theories that say, oh, well, the CIA or the generals did it because Kennedy was becoming more dovish and they wanted to get rid of him because they thought he was too soft on the Soviets, I think that's absurd. There's really no evidence at all to support this idea that Kennedy took a sudden leftward turn at the end of his administration. You know, I think the more likely theory is if anyone else was involved, it would have been Castro, because Oswald was a Marxist and Castro knew that the Americans were trying to kill him.
When somebody reads your book, what do you think they're going to be totally surprised about, aside from what you've already pointed out? Is there any segment of the book in the Kennedy legacy that is going to shock people?
Well, I was surprised to see, even doing the research, to see quite how religious he was. I mean, I think people knew he was a Catholic, but he was really quite a faithful Catholic, and that influenced him not just on social issues, where Kennedy called abortion repugnant and appointed to the Supreme Court the justice who wrote the dissent in the abortion rights case Roe v. Wade. Kennedy was for capital punishment, but also on these Cold War issues, where he really saw it as a conflict between the godless Soviet Union and America, which believed that rights came from God. So that stuff was surprising to me, and also just as a congressman and a senator, just how far to the right Kennedy was. I mean, he was critical of Truman, a president from his own party, for losing China to the communists. He voted in favor of laws requiring communists to register with the Justice Department and banning communists from the leadership of any labor unions. He actually went and had hearings to go after this communist labor leader in the United Auto Workers, who was eventually put in jail for lying to Congress about whether he was a communist. So kind of Kennedy's history as a congressman, just quite how far to the right he was. And, you know, people say, well, America as a whole at the time was anti-communist. There was a broad consensus. Even the Cold War liberals were anti-communist. Well, yes, but even by those standards, Kennedy was pretty far to the right.
Would you go so far as to call him a Tea Party radical, if a Tea Party existed then?
Well, it's funny. I was talking about this morning to somebody else who was interviewing me. I also wrote a book about Samuel Adams called Samuel Adams: A Life. So I know something about the original Boston Tea Party. And Kennedy, who was, after all, from Massachusetts, was quite familiar with the Tea Party. And in one of those speeches about free trade, in tariff reduction, he talked about the Boston Tea Party as one of the original. The Boston Tea Party, he said, was a rebellion against taxes on imports. And so Kennedy himself was not averse to citing the Boston Tea Party as a precedent for his policy actions when it came to taxes. And, you know, the Tea Party, one of the things it stands for is taxed enough already. And Kennedy, as a tax cutter, was quite in line with that idea.
It probably wouldn't be fair to call him a religious right-wing fundamentalist, even though he was a strict Catholic. Did he have kind of the Baptist view that the religious principles should be implemented by individuals freely choosing things, or did he actually support legislation on abortion or gays or any other religious issue?
Well, I mean, the only one where there's a clear record at the time is on aid to parochial schools, and Kennedy initially supported some government assistance for things like busing and textbooks, even school vouchers. Then when he ran for president as a Catholic, he sort of backed away from that because I think he thought that Protestant voters might object.
I appreciate all your insights. Ira Stoll, author of JFK, Tea Party Radical, or actually JFK Conservative, and you've touched on a lot of very interesting aspects that I think people are probably not aware of. Again, thank you for joining us, and we appreciate your contributions and comments on Kennedy and the other issues of the day.
My pleasure.
This is the Freedom News Hour. We're going to be off the air next week, taking Thanksgiving off. Walt Deason will be back the following week as the normal host for the show. And I appreciate him giving me the opportunity and appreciate Ira Stoll joining us for the show today. Freedom News Hour. Have a good one. Wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. This is PRN, the comprehensive news source for the world's progressive community. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Hi, this is Bhavani. I invite you to join me for my show, I Eat Green with Bhavani, live every Thursday morning at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, where I will share with you one of my favorite recipes and discuss topics related to food.